This Week in Virology, the podcast about viruses, the kind that make you sick. This Week in Virology, episode number 107, recorded November 12th, 2010. Hi, everybody. I'm Vincent Racaniello, and it's time for a little talk about viruses. And today we have a great crew, as usual, starting across the river in Fort Lee, New Jersey, Dixon Despommier.
Hey, Vince.
How are you, Dixon?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Sound like you're in a sewer.
A sewer? No, I'm in Fort Lee.
I'm sorry, it's just a little echoey, but you sound wonderful. Good to have you back. Four episodes in a row.
Yep.
Just like the old days. Thanks for joining us. Also, moving up the coast to Western Massachusetts, we have Alan Dove.
Good to be here.
Good to have you back as well. Is Western MA the same as always?
Pretty much. Chilly.
Excellent. Moving into winter. And let's go down to Florida, North Central Florida, where we could find a gator by the name of Rich Condit.
Hi, fellas.
Are you a gator?
You bet. I'm going to the game tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. Big one.
Big one tomorrow.
What's the game against?
It's South Carolina. It's kind of a shootout for the
conference.
The division title or whatever.
Mm.
It's amazing because we've lost a lot of games, but so have they. So it turns out to be a shootout anyway.
Right.
Can't say I follow a college football or any other kind.
You can't live in Gainesville without doing it.
I suppose.
You really got to have your head in the sand not to follow it if you live here. I didn't before I came here.
Well, there's plenty of sand to put your head in down there.
There's sand and sunshine. It's 76 degrees and a beautiful blue sky. Okay.
Here it's chilly.
Had to get that in.
Yeah, it's a little coolish here.
Well, let's see. Rich, you've been traveling. You were in Virginia, right?
That's correct.
For a transcription meeting.
Yeah, it snowed on me.
Cool.
But it was great. It was a terrific meeting. Really a nice meeting.
Well, I was in Paris for a ICAC conference where we try to arrange next year's meeting. And looks like we're going to have TWIV there, 2011.
Great.
So that'll be cool.
Let's go.
Won't be Paris. It'll be Chicago, right?
Yeah, it'll be in Chicago. And then I was in Mexico visiting some old friends. And Alan, you may remember Lorena.
Oh, yes.
So she says hi.
Oh, great. How's she doing?
Wonderful. They have both, her and Rosa, both have labs in Mexico doing virology. I'm very proud of them.
Excellent.
Had a great time. They're great people down there. Very friendly. And we did a TWIV. So that'll be airing at some point. Probably the Friday after Thanksgiving when we're all too full to talk. I'll put that one up.
But good idea.
Had a great visit. And we have fans down in Mexico. It's really great.
Great.
And to all of them listening, hi. Great to visit.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll see you next year. So today we have all email.
Great.
And we have some great emails, and there are many more, but we'll see what we can get through. So let's start with one from John. And he says, Dear Doctors et al., I'm writing to request a podcast or a discussion on colony collapse disorder. Right. Well, as you know, we did this a few TWIVs ago.
We did.
But we thank you anyway for asking. I wrote to him and said, you know, we did this episode. So he replied, Doctors and Residents of TWIV. Yes, it was a good show. I'm glad that there was discussion of civilian/military cooperation in science research, although I think Dr. Despommier is incorrect in his claim that bumbles don't sting.
Did I say that?
Yes,
you said that. There are witnesses.
And I was kind of wondering about it myself. I let it slide during the episode, but I thought, gosh.
I've never been stung by a bumblebee, but that doesn't mean they don't sting. All right.
Yeah, well, okay, so there's a compromise here. We'll get to this.
And then he says, P.S., after Dr. Dove left Dr. Racaniello's lab, did the latter train at the former School of Comedy in preparation for TWIP? I guess that's a compliment, right? Maybe not.
Probably is. Well, I don't. Yeah,
I mean, it is. At least it's recognized as comedy.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, Dixon. So we do fool around.
Okay.
We fool around on TWIP, right, Dixon?
Right.
Yeah, we have a good time. I'm not so funny, but I try to be
funny. No, you're a riot.
I mean, Alan is much more incisive in his comedy.
He's more of a punster.
Yes.
He's a punster. He's clever. I have just the, you know, buffoonery comedy. What is it you said? You know, that sort of thing.
Alan, where did you get that? Is there, you know, did you just come up with that or did your family teach you to pun?
Well, I don't know if it was nature or nurture, but there is a long tradition of this among the doves.
I see. Uh-huh. Okay. Fine.
Can you imagine a dove family reunion?
Oh, God.
No.
Must be funny. Yeah, it could get out of control.
Yeah. You wouldn't know what anybody was talking about.
So, Dixon, from Wikipedia, yes. Queen and worker bumblebees can sting. However, unlike a honeybee stinger, a bumblebee stinger lacks barbs, so they can sting more than once.
Uh-oh.
Bumblebee species are not normally aggressive, but will sting in defense of their nest or if harmed.
Got it.
Female cuckoo bumblebees will aggressively attack host colony members and sting the host queen, but will ignore other animals, including humans, unless disturbed.
Got it.
So you wanted to put them in your vertical farm, right?
Because I do. I still do.
So just don't bother them, and they'll be fine.
Precisely. Maybe that's what I meant to say.
Yeah.
Okay, let's take turns with these. Rich.
Ibrahim writes, "Hello, everybody. I was watching your Emerging Viruses lecture a day after listening to your Herbs TWIV episode. In the lecture, you stated that polio is probably present since the time of the Egyptians. Actually, Egyptians still exist. I am one."
That's a great one. That's a good one.
Yeah, that's good. Pharaohs are the ones who do not exist anymore. And my question is, why did not humans endogenize polio yet, since it was probably present before the Egyptians?
Good question.
So it's probably very ancient. And why is polio still causes symptoms after infection? It is shed in feces and can transmit easily among humans in a very stable cycle. Why is it still showing symptoms and sometimes killing its hosts, paralyzing lung muscles, and so on? Wasn't it better for polio to shift to being silent and endogenous? So is it a tendency of the virus to be silent with time, that some viruses do not choose this option, or a tendency for humans to endogenize some viruses and not others? Since I understand from the lecture and the TWIV episode that stability in virus-host relationships is the ultimate goal. Keep up the good work. Thanks.
I would argue that polio is pretty close to endogenized in humans. Most people who are infected don't have any problem with it.
99%.
Right.
I mean, by endogenized, of course, that means going into the genome, right?
Well, my sense is he's using that differently.
I think he's using. Yeah, I think he's using it as attenuated.
Okay.
Yeah, sort of.
All right. Yeah,
stabilized,
yeah.
Equilibrated with the host in basically a non-pathogenic fashion.
So do we know whether or not there's a subset of humans that are more susceptible to the pathogenic effects of polio?
That's a good question. No one has ever associated any polymorphism with greater susceptibility. People have looked, you know, at HLA polymorphisms that sort of thing. And now that there are so few cases, it's hard to answer. They're all in certain small populations. But I don't know. It's a good question.
And with respect to the transmission and stuff, that's the way this particular virus works. As we've discussed before, you know, I used to have, matter of fact, I still talk in classes about the idea that, yes, viruses tend to evolve towards equilibrating with their hosts and use the myxoma in Australia paradigm or model as an example of that. But as we've discussed here, it all has to do with transmission. And sometimes the mechanism of transmission requires a certain symptomology in the host. For example, chickenpox. It's, you know, you got to have blisters assist in the transmission. So you really have to have that symptomology to maintain the transmission chain. So it kind of depends. But I agree with you, Alan. Most polio infections don't do much.
Yeah, of course, if you're one of the 1% that get affected by it, it can be horrific. But,
absolutely.
You know, and that's why there's a vaccine.
There's an outbreak in the Congo at the moment. I don't know if you
right. Know
that, but quite a few deaths in that.
Mm. Yeah.
I think over 150 deaths. And so that's unusual. And it's all in older people. Yeah. So, you know, the 1% number.
Have they checked out the virus?
I think they I saw somewhere, I think on ProMed Mail, that it's a wild type. At least some of the sequences have shown that it's a wild type, type 1, I believe.
Interesting.
But the curious thing is why it's in older people. So we don't have enough data yet, but as soon as we do, we will talk about it for sure. I don't know. Maybe it's been into people rather recently, like measles, and so it still retains some pathogenicity. It could be that in another 10,000 years, it would be completely avirulent. Mm-hmm. It's like some other infections that we have, which don't do anything.
Right.
I don't know. Now, just in case he's asking about real endogenization, why it hasn't gone in the genome,
yep,
that's probably because the virus nucleic acid doesn't go into the nucleus.
Uh-huh.
So there's no opportunity for it to be reverse transcribed by a cellular reverse transcriptase and integrated. That would be my guess.
Right.
Yeah.
These viruses that endogenize tend to be nuclear. Okay, let's see. Alan, can you read Ricardo's?
Yes, Ricardo writes, "Hello, Vincent." But I'll read it anyway. "I just saw your video about social media and microbiology education. Very interesting. In the end, when you were asking for future evolution, you mentioned students' blog as part of their grade. I started a wiki page for my students. Each had to explore a theme. The good things that came out of the experience were an increase in interest throughout the semester. I could control if the students were doing their work or not. Some competition, which led to improvements on their wikis because students could see all wikis. A nice set of skills, IT knowledge, improved graphic presentation, rich bibliographic search." Apparently, he didn't allow Google or Wikipedia bibliographic entries. "And more interest than just regular report. About TWIV and TWIP, well, I just have the best commute I could have. My best regards. P.S. I think I will try to include TWIV or TWIP for extra credit in my classes."
I think it's a good idea. I was thinking for my class next semester to have to make a blog for the students and have them periodically write something. My son's history teacher last year did that. He had once a week students had to post. He would post a story and they would have to write a reaction. And it would be on the blog for everyone to see. Not a bad idea.
Yeah.
The nice thing about a wiki is that it could evolve through the semester.
Think that'd be more flexible than a blog?
Depends on what you want to accomplish. If you have one, I mean, it sounds like what Ricardo did. And Ricardo, by the way, is an assistant professor of microbiology at Fernando Pessoa University in Portugal. So he's teaching there. And I gather what he did was that students had to pick topics. At least I assume that's the way it was organized. And then they had to work on their specific topic as if they were working on a Wikipedia type entry. If you organized it that way, then I think that's a very good choice. So if you wanted to do weekly topics and keep changing them, then you'd probably want a blog.
So wiki, everyone can in theory change everything, right?
Yeah.
You can control permissions on it if you like. So you could have it set up so that each student could edit his or her own page and not edit the others or submit suggestions to edit the others or something like that.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I'd like to explore that. I did assign blog readings in TWIV last year, but I'd like them to be a little more active. And if they see themselves on the web, it might, like he says, be a little more motivating.
Yeah.
And of course, the novelty will wear off and that's it. And then he says an increase in interest throughout the semester will become a decrease in interest. But thank you, Ricardo. It's a good idea. Professor De Pommier, would you read? Oh, you don't have them in front of you, do you?
Yes, I do.
Can you read Sue's?
Yes, I do. And I can read too, so I will be happy to do so.
I hope so.
Sue writes, VCV.
No, that's just our initials.
Dear virologist, that's a singular. I don't know who she's addressing this to, but it's not me because I'm not a virologist. The Tre recombinase people think that in 10 years they might be able to use their method in a clinical setting to attempt to remove retrovirus from host. Are you as optimistic?
Yeah.
And RC says no.
That's a completely uninformed no, but I react strongly to grand claims like that.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
I don't know if you guys know. I actually had not been aware of this work.
Would you mind explaining?
I tried to look up Trey Recombinase last night in my internet crash, but I got it right here. An experimental enzyme that in lab tests has successfully removed DNA inserted by HIV from infected cells.
Right.
The enzyme was derived from Cre recombinase, which is a site-specific recombinase that will remove DNA that is flanked by appropriate sequences. Mm-hmm. So the enzyme was derived from Cre recombinase through selective mutation for the purpose of identifying HIV markers which are not bounded by LOX-P sites, those are the specific sequences, and therefore disallow attempts at Cre-LOX recombination. Okay, so this is an enzyme that will, recognize conserved sequences that flank proviral DNA in integrated HIV mm-hmm. and pop it out even in infected cells. And I'm sure that that's possible. That's how the Cre recombinase is typically used. You can introduce the enzyme into cells in a variety of different ways, and you can delete DNA between two markers. So that's interesting.
Yeah, so they did it in infected cells in culture, and they removed all the proviruses from, I think, HeLa cells. So in culture it works, and I think they would probably try it in animals, although this is reported in 2008, and I haven't seen anything yet.
Geez, so how would you, for an HIV-infected person, you'd have to somehow get this into every cell that contains proviral DNA.
Right.
And precisely excise it. I'm skeptical.
Yeah, that's a hard one, right?
But then again, people wind up doing things that I'm skeptical about, and they make a lot of money.
What I'm skeptical about is the deadline on it.
Uh-huh.
10 years is a yeah. very short time frame to move something from cell culture to the clinic, particularly when it's an entirely new concept like this. So I would bet against it, but as Rich just said, I would probably bet small amounts of money against it.
Well, if we took the time limit away, I mean, we could say that eventually it might work. It depends, right?
There's no theoretical reason to say that it's impossible. If it works in cells, humans are made of a lot of cells.
Yeah. And we've done other gene therapy to deliver proteins to people
with
viral vectors. Yeah, they don't work great, unfortunately. We can't even effectively give people the right hemoglobin, right? And correct hemoglobinopathies. So it's not easy, but in theory it should be doable. But
maybe we ought to do this paper for a TWIV somewhere down the road. It looks like the isolation of the recombinase is an interesting experimental thing. They evolved it somehow.
It's very cool. Yeah. Apparently the LTR of HIV, it has some homology with the LOX sequences, the target of this Cre recombinase. Uh-huh. So they were able to start with one LTR and evolve the Cre so that it cut it out more efficiently. So yeah, we should do that at some point.
Yeah,
because that I missed it. I had not seen it until.
Yeah, this. Thank you for the letter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Educate us. That's good.
The next one's from Jeffrey, who writes, "Gentlemen, I was listening to TWIV 82 about dengue fever and the host's changed response upon reinfection. It occurs to me to ask, could this changed response be a factor in other diseases that have differing short and long-term infectivity symptomology? In particular, I was wondering about measles/shingles. Okay, now, I don't know if he means chickenpox/shingles or measles/SSPE.
Right.
Because there's no measles/shingles, right?
That's a mixed metaphor.
Right. Is it possible that the original measles infection stimulates an immune response that works fine over the host's lifetime for most tissues, but actually makes some tissue types more sensitive to subsequent infection, whether by the same or similar strain? It is in these cells that the shingles viruses reside and activate their different symptomatology. Perhaps I'm making this too complicated. Perhaps measles virus doesn't need the original infection's priming action and the difference in tissue types is enough, but I, in my ignorance, thought it worth asking."
That's a good question.
It's always worth asking.
Yep. Well, if it's measles slash SSPE, which is the long-term neurodegenerative sequelae, We don't really know how that works, as far as I know. I mean, there seems to be some measles sequence around, but how it persists and causes a problem is absolutely not known. And it may have something to do with immune responses.
True.
But if you're talking about chickenpox / shingles, then we know that the chickenpox integrates its genome into your cells, and then many years later it reactivates and you get shingles. I think it probably has something to do with waning immunity.
Yeah, right? I think in particular in that case, waning immunity, because it happens in old people.
Yeah, us.
Like us.
There's an interesting correlate at the higher life form with Toxocara canis, which causes visceral larva migraines, which is a childhood disease primarily for them coming in contact with this Ascaris of dogs. As they become more and more infected with this parasite over time, because of their propensity to play in the sand, so to speak, immunity kicks in and prevents this from becoming a VLM, that's visceral larva. And in fact, it ends up in the eye as an OLM. And it's an immunological refuge. That is to say, the immune system doesn't do very well at attacking the eye. And so this parasite ends up in a safe haven, due to the immune response sort of pushing it out of all the other places, and this is the last place it goes to. So there are some correlates with this particular way of thinking about diseases, the occurrence of immunity and then reinfections that crosses all kinds of infectious disease borders, and size in this case doesn't matter.
The thing about the dengue is that the first infection really enhances the pathogenesis of subsequent infections. And aside from some issues with some vaccines that have had difficulties, I can't think of, and I don't claim to be omniscient in this regard, I can't think of any other examples that are quite like dengue. Do you guys know of any? Yeah.
I think it's rather unique in that way. But none come to mind.
Well, if there's somebody out there who knows, enlighten us.
Yeah.
All right, Rich.
Right. James writes, do they seem promising to you guys? And is the theory sound, or with the influenza virus point or shuffle out of it? This is a very cryptic message. But apparently, our notes here say, somebody commented, is there something missing here, or was this really the whole letter? And Vincent responds that the subject line in the email was the universal influenza virus vaccine. So I think we can take this as a cue to discuss whether the universal influenza virus vaccine is, and whether or not it's going to go anywhere.
Yeah. And I'm going to just make a very easy bet that James Bernstein, MD, is probably a practicing physician.
Yes.
They tend to send very short emails.
It's kind of like their prescriptions.
Because they have about 30 seconds between patients.
Right.
So no offense, James.
No, it's just fine. Well, we haven't talked about these on TWIV yet. I did blog about them, and I'll put a link to that. But there are a couple of different groups working on this, and to my surprise, they actually look promising. One approach is the Palese group. So the idea is that with most flu vaccines, you get antibodies to the globular head of the hemagglutinin, and these are the ones. This is the part of the protein that changes every year, so your immunity is useless. He took the approach of immunizing with the stem of the HA, which is conserved, and you get very broadly reacting antibodies. In fact, when you immunize with an H1 stem, you can neutralize all H1 strains pretty much starting from 1918 to the present.
Wow.
So that's pretty promising. And then the other group is Gary Nabel at NIH.
Oh, yes.
What he has done is a different approach, but the same result. He first immunizes with a plasmid encoding the HA, so it's a DNA vaccine, and then he boosts with an adenovirus expressing the HA. And for some reason, that way of delivering the antigen gives you broadly neutralizing antibodies, and they're directed against the stem as well. Even though he doesn't immunize with the stem, for some reason, DNA followed by ad boost, it does it.
It may be because the DNA vaccine is going to express the HA on a cell surface, and that may provide greater accessibility to antibodies to get at it. Just a thought.
So either way, I was actually amazed.
It's a good thought.
And I think within 10 years, we're going to have a universal influenza vaccine. You're going to get it at a year of age, and you're going to forget about it. And it doesn't matter if a pandemic strain comes along, you're going to neutralize it.
Wouldn't that be nice?
So I'm optimistic, but I think this stuff is really impressive.
You actually had this discussion with Peter Palazzi on the TWIV where you went to Munich. Is that right?
Actually, that's a good point. He did talk about it on that.
He gave a very clear description and cautious optimism about it. And that was a nice discussion.
Yes,
so you can link that too.
James, yes. Go back. James doesn't have time to listen to it.
Well, he can do it at two times the speed.
That's right.
Peter will work at that. That'll be okay.
Times the speed. Alan.
So Jim writes, Vince, another one for you.
Thank you.
In case you haven't seen this, Clear Lab is being developed by Muzzy Lane Software in partnership with the Federation of American Scientists, curriculum developers from K-12, and science teachers around the country. The project's primary goal is to develop games that improve student performance on standardized assessments and that foster lifelong passion for science. And he gives a link to this Clear Lab project. It looks very promising. When I first saw this letter in the queue, I immediately went here and tried to play the games. And they now have a beta up. So maybe you can. It looks like maybe some cool science themed games.
I mean, games for learning are good in theory. They have to be good.
Yes.
So I thought we could just share it with everyone.
People can check it out. You have to log in order to play, apparently.
So you have to have an account. Probably it's a free account. Yeah. Create account. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks for that, Jim. Dr. Despommier.
Another Jim writes, Vince, you're a very popular guy on this show.
I have to take that out. This it's not to me. I don't know why they wrote it.
Well, whatever. It says, can you lead me to any place that offers a simple discussion of the protein portraits or cartoons so commonly used in your lectures, texts, and every other professional discussion of the entire microbiological field? As an old retired guy, sounds like me, I'd much prefer a classic comics version. That doesn't sound like me, if such a thing exists.
I cannot come up with anything here, guys. I thought you might.
How cartoony can you get besides the cartoons of proteins that already exist?
I'm not entirely clear on what he's looking for. Does he want a discussion about what these cartoons mean? Because that's actually kind of an important issue.
He's talking about protein structures, right?
Right. People draw cartoons of proteins all the time, and if you're talking about those, there's no common nomenclature to them. It's just whatever people. I tend to draw them like Pac-Man if they're enzymes, and I draw them as circles if they're if they're receptors. then they look like lollipops. Mm. But if he's looking for a discussion of protein structure, like the ribbon structures, the computer models that you see, that's a little more complicated. And I don't have a good reference for him either, like a simple explanation of what that notation means.
Well, if anyone listening knows something, send it to us.
To some extent, the short version is that those computer structures are supposed to look like the real thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And there are all rules for expressing, alpha helices and beta sheets and all those other things. So if he's looking for the rules of how these things are drawn, then I think a lot of proteomic sites have that already. So we could suggest him going there.
I would go to the protein data bank. They have some pretty good.
That's what I was thinking of.
They have some pretty good resources there. And I think we've picked this before. There's a lot of heavy science, but there's some basic stuff on protein structure and really nice pictures.
Exactly.
So that would be my suggestion.
We can put a link to that in the notes.
We will. All right. The next one is from Blue Phase. I love the podcast. A special thanks to TWIV team for doing an amazing job, since in a lot of your podcasts, You have discussed so much about flu viruses, I thought you might like this one on flu GFP virus. He sends a link to a PNAS paper.
Huh.
And PNAS is a bit slow today.
Yeah. No,
here we go. Analysis of in vivo dynamics of influenza virus infection in mice using a GFP reporter virus from the Garcia Sastre lab here in New York City.
Pretty pictures.
Very nice. They made a flu virus with GFP and used it to track infection in mice.
Good idea.
Cool stuff.
Great. It's very good stuff. Yeah, that's cool. And if you'd like to see Dr. Garcia Sastre dancing, you should check out the TWIV in Munich. There's a link to a movie of him. His lab did enjoy that, I believe. Okay.
So what do we have here? Green mouse lungs?
Green mouse lungs, yeah.
Yeah.
Green mouse lungs.
Yeah. It's a great way to track movement. Yeah, you can see the lungs are quite nicely outlined in lovely colors here. So you can look at the effect of mutation and different doses of virus, etc. It's a nice paper. Thank you, Blue Phase. Nice name. Keep up the great work. Rich, you got an email from Rich.
Yeah, how about that? It's not me. Rich writes, Dear TWIV guys, love your show. Actually, I'm chronically infected with TWIV. Just wanted to add an update to TWIV number 80 on hepatitis B. It is true that up until about 1986, the hepatitis vaccine was quite expensive, and developing countries were not able to afford it. Then a group of people that I had the privilege to work with, the International Task Force on Hepatitis B Immunization, set about to make the vaccine affordable in developing countries. Since that time, the vaccine has dropped in price, and today UNICEF can get it for less than 20 cents a dose.
Wow.
Wow.
Excellent.
The price is no longer a barrier to the availability of the vaccine. Great. I have listened to every TWIV show up to number 80, and I'm looking for every spare minute to get current. I have arranged for a link to your show to appear on my organization's website. I hope every person interested in how viruses affect human health can listen to your superb podcast.
Wow.
Wow, that's terrific. Very nice. And he gives a link to his organization.
The Pediatric Dengue, Pediatric Dengue Vaccine Initiative. I'm getting a no link here.
Yeah, me too.
Here it is. PDVI.org. It's the
it's reversed from what it says here.
Got Pediatric it. Dengue Vaccine Initiative.
Right. Yeah.
Very nice. And somewhere on there is a link to TWIV.
I think it's wonderful that there are people out there who dedicate themselves to making this stuff available to people who need it inexpensively. I think it's wonderful.
There we go. On the links page, This Week in Virology. Excellent.
Which raises a point that I was going to make anyway, but it doesn't relate to viruses necessarily. But the epidemic of cholera right now raging in Haiti just absolutely depresses the hell out of me. I just heard recently today, for instance, that over 700 people have died from cholera. You know, no one has to die from cholera. You just have to give oral rehydration for 3 days and you live. But those poor people can't even receive the bare minimum treatment. It's just very depressing to realize that something as ancient and as treatable as this is still going on right in our own backyard. And WHO estimates that $164 million is needed to intervene here. So, you know, for 20 cents a dose to $164 million, we create these problems, and then we have to fight our way out of paper bags to get to the next step. It's just frustrating. So.
It's probably worth pointing out that even with the 20 cents a dose, you still need someone who can inject it.
This is all true. This is right.
So,
yeah, it's outstanding that they brought it down, because that does certainly, bringing the price down that much does open it up to a lot more people, particularly in the not super poor countries, but somewhat poor countries who can maybe distribute it, but couldn't afford to buy it. But the sad truth is that in a lot of parts of the world, and Haiti is a very current example, the barrier is not buying the stuff; it's just getting it to people. Yeah, it's logistics. You know, if you can't get clean drinking water, you can't do oral rehydration therapy.
And for hepatitis B, it's also a 3-dose series. Is that
you
correct?
Need, yes, you need follow up.
So you got to get people back 3 times.
Right,
it's hard.
So it's a real problem.
I hope someday the HPV vaccine is this cheap,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
Because everyone should have that. And right now, it's I think 3 doses, $100 or $150 a dose.
Yeah,
it's expensive.
I think the HPV vaccine was just as bad when it first came out. It was really expensive.
HPV.
Yeah.
Was,
on the other hand, the companies who are developing these, you know, they're in a pickle because you've got to make back your research and development costs at some point. And vaccines are regarded historically as a public good, and there's no money in making a public good. So it's a real problem for industry.
Yep.
As Dixon says in his book, The Vertical Farm, some things we just shouldn't have to make profits about. Over, right? It was a good argument, Dixon. All right, the next one is from Andre, who writes, "Hi, I love your TWIV podcast. I find the honest and witty banter among the TWIV cast crew and guests to be most refreshing, entertaining, and educational. It's addictive. I'm a PCR scientist in a provincial government veterinary diagnostic lab, Manitoba, Canada. We routinely test by PCR for several viruses and microbes in livestock animals, over 30,000 samples per year. Back in 1997, despite being swamped with diagnostic PCR samples during a BVDV outbreak, using PCR we were able to identify and sequence a new virus in pigs, now known as porcine circovirus type 2, PCV2. As diagnostic technologies rapidly evolve, it can be overwhelming to keep up with recent advances. Can you recommend any online molecular diagnostics forums specific for veterinary diagnostic labs?"
Wow.
"I'm familiar with various BioNet news groups, but find they're too general for our needs. Keep up the great work and having fun, and for fellow listeners, please assure us that you plan to continue beyond 100 episodes." Well,
Here we are.
Yep.
That's right, we're up to 107 now. Here you go.
I don't know of any.
I don't know of any
for specific for veterinary diagnostic labs.
You should start one.
But I thought that if we have 10,000 listeners, someone out there must know about it.
Yeah.
So there you go. That's a pretty specific request. But yeah, actually, that's a good idea, Dixon. He should start one.
I mean, if there isn't one, you should start one.
Yeah. You know, there wasn't a virology podcast, so we started one.
There you go.
Yeah, and this is a fairly specific request, but the internet is built for specific requests.
That's right. That's right.
So my suggestion would be maybe start it up as something easy like a forum.
Yeah.
Use a PHPBB or something and just run a forum for people who are in the field and get your colleagues to sign on and start discussing this stuff and see if you develop a following.
Right.
Here, here.
I think I preempted you, Alan. I'm sorry.
Oh,
it was
sorry.
Your turn. I think you should do Mary's.
Ah, great. So Mary writes, "Vincent et al., excellent program, and not just because you read my letter. Thank you. Far more important were the ideas you presented to counter the prevailing notion that all viruses are bad. The agricultural implications mentioned by Marilyn Rossing were especially interesting for me. I know you hear this all the time, but I'll say it too. Important work you're doing here. Excellent job. Keep up the good work, et cetera, et cetera." Mary Yule from Small Things Considered. And my comment to Mary would be, back at you, Mary. If any TWIV listeners haven't checked out Small Things Considered, you really ought to get over to that blog and read it. It's outstanding.
Should also mention that Mary and Forrest Rower have co-authored a book, which was a pick by... Grant McFadden when we were in Florida. It's called Coral Reefs in the Microbial Seas, and I read it on my travels, and it is fabulous. Dixon, you would love it. You guys would love it.
Yeah.
I didn't know anything about the coral reefs. It's amazing.
Aha.
The holobiont. It's an incredible collection of coral and dinoflagellates and bacteria.
Oh, yeah.
And he talks about why it's getting all messed up, and we have to have him on at some point, because there are a lot of viruses involved. Do you know there are herpes viruses in coral?
Wow.
It's really cool. So Mary's a co-author of that book. Really great. We'll get him on. We'll talk about coral and viruses and other things. That'll be cool. But right now he's out doing some exploratory stuff down in the reefs in the Pacific. So We have to wait till he gets back.
A lot of coral reefs are being bleached by a rising temperature in the sea surfaces.
So what I learned was temperature, acidity,
yep,
and agricultural runoff.
That's right.
That makes the bacteria grow, yep, kills the coral, then the fish die.
Yep.
Also, overfishing will do it.
Yep.
Take away the fish, boom. Yep.
Why should we care if coral reefs disappear? And, you know, that's an argument for people who don't know what coral reefs actually do, but they tend to sequester a lot of calcium carbonate, so there's a very important carbon sink. And without that carbon sink, that carbon has to go someplace else, and it usually ends up in the wrong place.
Yep. You would like this book, Dixon.
I'm sure.
You would love it.
Absolutely.
Okay, that was Alan, and that. Let's do Dixon.
All right, you're going to give me all the short ones today. That's fine.
It's the luck of the draw, Dixon.
Okay, Pritesh writes, has any research been done on the distribution of envelope glycoproteins on viral surface? Especially in the context of viruses that use specific receptors from the many they have. But I guess each one is present for some definite function. A little interesting phraseology there. But and he says, thanks from Pritesh at Georgia State University. Any guys out there got an answer to this one?
Not sure that the
I don't.
The distribution on the viral surface, I'm not sure. Do you mean that how much glycoprotein is present? I mean, all I know about that is some viruses are very densely packed on the surface and others are less so. So, for example, influenza virus, the glycoproteins are very tightly packed, they're dense, and HIV is not. And I learned that actually in Munich, a talk from Michel Nussenzweig. He said the glycoproteins on the HIV surface are very sparse, and that's why it's very difficult for antibodies to neutralize because they can't attach to both to two glycoproteins at one time.
I had that in my head somewhere, and I didn't know where it came from. It must have been TWIV.
Maybe.
Yeah.
You can learn things from TWIV, right?
Yeah.
I don't know the other part. Especially in the context of viruses that use specific receptors from the many they have. So some viruses, I guess he means, have a lot of glycoproteins and only use one or two as receptor binding proteins, right?
Well, but I think that's just going to be taken care of by binding dynamics. As the virus drifts into a cell, the one that can stick will, I would assume.
Some of the proteins are for attachment. So your virus, for example, Richard, has a lot of surface proteins, right?
Yeah.
And some are for attachment, others for maybe fusion and
right,
other things that we don't know about. The herpes viruses have lots of surface glycoproteins. A lot are involved in attachment and fusion. So I don't know anything more specific than
I think sort of the textbook cartoon idea of this is, you know, you got a bunch of glycoproteins swimming around in a membrane. But my guess is it's more what he's pointing to here, it seems to me, is that it may be more organized than that. And he's probably right. But I don't know of anybody who knows what that organization might be.
Yeah. All right, Pritesh. Sorry if you don't like that, but, you know.
That's the best answer we've got.
Well,
got
no, it. I mean, he's got a PhD thesis there. Where is he? Georgia State University? Get on it, dude.
Right? That's right.
Anyway, we have a lot of people who can probably contribute. All right. Rich gets the long one.
Yes. Holy cow. Okay. So I'm going to delete the bracketed parts,
okay,
right?
Okay. Yeah, that's fine.
I'm a student. Benjamin writes, I'm a student at Grinnell College on the cusp of finishing a degree in biological chemistry. I found your podcast this summer via the advertisement you made in one of the episodes of ASM's Meet the Scientist podcast. I was able to finish all 92 so far episodes of TWIV this month. Holy cow. I found your podcast deeply interesting, and it has put virology on my radar as a possible career path.
Nice.
92 in a month. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
One concern that is somewhat tangential to most of your discussion is the occasional mention of telomeres and aging. While I don't think I heard anything that was outright incorrect, I would often hear the mention of telomerase toned as if it caused aging, which does not. In fact, telomerase is what helps maintain the youth of a cell by allowing it to replicate for a longer period of time. As such, the cells in humans that most often express telomerase are germline cells. Cancers also tend to express the gene, since it removes the limits to the number of times a cell can divide. One of the reasons that HeLa cells are so useful is that they have this gene switched on, meaning that they can be cultured indefinitely without the typical result of culturing non-cancerous human tissue, which is an inevitable halt to division. Let me see, does this go on in the same, as far as I know, most, if not all eukaryotes, I've been intrigued by a counterexample, have a linear chromosome and thus use telomeres as a protective measure against the loss of coding sequences caused during every replication of a linear chromosome. The end problem, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Yes.
Most prokaryotes have circular DNA, thus avoiding the shortening effects of replicons. Telomerase itself just extends the telomere, which is merely a repeating non-coding sequence, thus increasing the cell's reproductive longevity by delaying the inevitable cleavage of important genetic material that would occur if a cell line were to replicate without expressing telomerase.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good summary.
Let's pause there for a minute and make sure we got that locked down, because then he goes to another topic. So, yeah, I think we've probably slipped occasionally by at least indicating that immortalization involved changes in telomerase, or maybe even implying that the telomerase enzyme itself was mutant in immortalized cells. And what he's pointing out is the other way around. The telomerase puts the telomeres on. And that would extend the life of the cells, because
right, the change you want in telomerase is you want it kept on under conditions where it would otherwise be turned
right.
off.
Right. So that is a nice summary.
And yeah. I like how it ties in with our DNA replication, yeah, right. The end problem. Yeah.
Another topic that came up repeatedly was the discussion of viruses as living or non-living. Have we discussed that?
A few times.
I've discussed my thoughts on the matter in a comment on the virus and the virion post on your virology blog. The comment I'd like to make in this email is with regard to vaccine terminology. Often the topic of whether to use the words like activated or inactivated in place of live and killed, because viruses fail to meet the classic criteria of life. Personally, I prefer live and killed, both because they require fewer syllables and because they're more intuitive. A killed vaccine doesn't carry the same connotation of being ineffectual that inactivated vaccine does, and it doesn't take as long to say it. Further, I would like to point out that those two words are not exclusively used with reference to entities that are living by the classical definition. Live grenades and killed microphones are perfectly acceptable phrases in the English what the heck? I lost it here.
Yeah, it just did a frame shift.
The text just moved around. Did somebody edit?
I thought it was my brain that moved around, okay? Are perfectly acceptable phrases in the English language. So regardless of your thoughts on the living or non-living nature of viruses, I think that you can feel free to say live and killed as modifiers for viruses and viral vaccines without stigma. So, great. You're excused.
That's a good argument. I got to just say that I have... You know, since I'm a big proponent of the virion is not living, whenever I say live virus, people give me hell. So maybe they're right, because I have to be consistent, so I try and correct myself. But he's got a good argument. Is that how you say a killed microphone? I guess.
I didn't know that. I am familiar with live grenades.
Kill that mic.
Yeah, I know you can kill the engine, too.
Kill the engine.
It's true.
Yeah. All right. Good point.
Right.
Viral evolution is a topic that really piqued my interest, and I am looking forward to checking out Luis Villarreal's book from my colleague's science library when the new semester starts. So, without much background in the topic, I have a couple of questions of a speculative nature that I was wondering if you could discuss. How does he have time to do this if he's listening to all 92 episodes?
Interesting. I guess he listens and types.
One of the interesting things about organisms is the universality of DNA as the genome medium, as well as the near universality of the genetic code, and the alternative codes are only slightly different than the canonical one. Is it possible that dicers played a key role in the demise of RNA-based organism in the primordial sea? I also remember hearing on your podcast that Mimi viruses package some of their own transfer RNA, which made me wonder if the viral tRNAs of this monster had in any way acted to modify the genetic code for the virus.
You know, this is actually a good point. It may not be dicer, but so we think there was first an RNA world, and then RNA was replaced by DNA, and probably because it's more stable, and there were probably a bunch of RNA enzymes that had evolved that would attack the RNA. So when DNA came around, probably accidentally, and there's some evidence that it evolved in two separate times, it had an advantage, a selective advantage. Mm-hmm. Because all these RNA enzymes, maybe dicer, maybe other RNases, couldn't attack it. So that's one of the ideas about why DNA genomes evolved. And then once they were there, they had a big advantage because they could be much bigger than DNA than RNA genomes. So he's right. I think that's pretty
interesting.
Cool.
And this idea that tRNAs might actually play a role in the evolution of a specific code for a virus. It's an interesting idea. I don't think that there's any evidence for that in Mimi virus, but it's an interesting idea. Yep. By the way, Mimi virus is not the only virus that encodes tRNAs. I first encountered this many years ago, bacteriophage T4.
That's right. Yeah.
Encodes tRNAs. And I think those were discovered genetically. I'd have to go revisit this, but I think they found that they could evolve suppressor tRNAs that made it so you couldn't make mutants in the virus or something like that. So the tRNAs can impact on the, at least on the life cycle of the virus. Okay. To wrap up, I'd like to suggest two websites to check out. The first is one of the blogs at Seed Media's science blogs called IRV, which, as you can guess by the name, is about endogenous retroviruses. It's written by Abigail Smith, a graduate student from the University of Oklahoma who studies retroviruses. The writing can be a bit informal at times, but she often writes about interesting topics. Second link I'd like to send on is Hans Rosling's Gapminder. He's talked on TED before, and his first talk is here. He gives the link. Their Gapminder World software is a great source for visualizing the relationships between various national indicators, and a few of them are under the health section and have direct relevance to virology, though the data covers a broad array of domains and can keep you busy for hours looking at different relationships when you're not listening to 92 episodes of TWIB.
Exactly.
Wow.
Or writing a blog, which he links to, which is pretty cool.
This is a busy guy.
Very.
Yeah, nice. Thanks a lot, Ben. That's great. All right, now, who are we up to? I've forgotten. Is it Dixon's turn?
After me is, I thought after me was
Alan.
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 Oh, okay.
Alan, you there?
Here I am. So, Jenny writes, Dear Dr. Reck and Yellow and TWIV guys, I'm a patient with chronic fatigue syndrome, and I found TWIV when you discussed XMRV on the show. My background in science consists of the PhDs held by my parents and brother, none in virology, but I love TWIV. Your discussions are informative and usually easy to understand. I am learning a lot from the show and will keep listening. Using the podcast to make science more accessible to the general public is brilliant. I would also like to thank Dr. Racaniello for giving a webinar on XMRV for the CFIDS Association. The CFS community needs to understand how science will solve the XMRV question, even if the pace is too slow for us as individuals. You perform a great service in sharing a scientist's point of view of the topic. Full disclosure, I'm a member of the association's board of directors, but I know many patients appreciated your perspective and participation. Thanks for your terrific work, Jenny Spatilla.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And thank you.
Yes, that's really nice, because coming from a CFS patient, that's a nice encouragement for doing the show the way we do, because this has been an inflammatory topic.
Yes.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. Dixon, you get a long one now.
Okay. Richard writes, Dear guys, okay, I did it. With a start at about May 1st, I caught up through all 92 TWIVs.
Another marathon listener.
Yeah. Got two of them here. TWIV has become a very important part of my work. I want to tell you about what I do because it is a new profession. And I think the several people who do what I do would benefit as much from TWIV as I have. I am the director of vaccine access for the Pediatric Dengue Vaccine Initiative, a program of the International Vaccine Institute. The organizations like the Dengue Initiative are called Product Development Partnerships, PDPs for short. They are like small nonprofit drug and vaccine development companies. All of them are supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and other donors. They always work in partnership with one or more private companies. For example, we have worked with Sanofi Pasteur, GlaxoSmithKline, Hawaii Biotech, and Envirogen. We collaborate in very different ways with each organization. With Hawaii Biotech and Envirogen, we pay for the production of the clinical lots they needed to get into phase one testing. A core function of a PDP is to help plan for the introduction of the new product into developing countries and reach the poor in those countries. It is basically what I am and my excess colleagues do. When friends ask me what I do, I say I am like the vice president for global marketing for a vaccine company, except my market is the poor in developing countries. At any rate, there are about 12 PDPs, and several are concerned with vaccines: TB, malaria, AIDS, hookworm, cholera, shigellosis, rotavirus, typhoid fever, and pneumococcal disease. Not one of the access directors is a trained virologist or vaccinologist, as far as I can count. However, to do our job, we must understand viruses and how they make you sick. In quotes, that's a Vince quote. So I'd like you to know that your program is contributing to making vaccines available to the poor in developing countries. Your discussion of dengue has been very good and helpful, and I have learned a great deal from all the other episodes. I hope all my excess colleagues will listen to TWIV, and I have written to them separately suggesting they do so. I wonder if you could consider doing a program on the vaccine PDPs. I attach a paper by Mary Moran and colleagues that will provide more information. With congratulations for a truly amazing science breakthrough, Richard T. Mahoney, PhD, Director, Access, Pediatric Dengue Vaccine Initiative, International Vaccine Institute in Seoul, Korea, and then it gives his other contact information. I think that's an amazing, letter we just got, guys, because you don't know who you're affecting, and especially with my ignorance input for this show, and here is a whole group of people who are taking the funding agencies, massaging it and bringing it down to the level where it's absolutely essentially necessary, and then bringing it into the community where it's needed most. And they credit us with doing something that none of, at least I didn't think I was doing anything more than just informing the general public as to what a virus might be and what it might be doing to you. So I'm extremely proud to be part of this group and to be part of your initiative. So thank you very much for those informative compliments.
And I just realized this must be the same Rich Mahoney who we read just a few letters ago.
Yes.
Right. So, okay.
He listened so very quickly.
Yeah. We should have grouped those. Yeah.
I think it would be great to have someone from the PDP, from a PDP, to tell us about it.
Well, this is a telephone number. Maybe we can have him on Skype.
Oh, look, he's got a Skype. Excellent.
We've never Skyped as far away as, like, Korea.
It should work fine.
Why not?
It should work fine.
So I will link to the article he sent about PDPs. Thank you, Richard.
Yep.
Excellent.
Judy writes, I believe I'm next, right?
Yep.
Yes, you are.
Judy writes, first, thanks to all of you for the wonderful education you are giving us. I am a high school science teacher, and you are great professional development for me, especially since there is no funding for conferences. Right. And as an educator, I know the amount of work it takes to prep a lesson. I am amazed at the amount of work you all do for the common good. You are truly educators. I would like enlightenment, please, about gel filtration. Gel filtration was described as beads in a column that size separated materials. I thought gel filtration as size separation by molecules in an agarose or acrylamide media by electrophoresis. The procedure with beads and pores is, I thought, size exclusion chromatography.
Aha!
Chromatography can also be ionic, hydrophobic, or affinity columns. Can you clarify what is the difference between filtration and chromatography anyhow?
I can understand her confusion here because there is some ambiguity in the usage of words. One of the problems here is the word gel.
Yes.
Because gels are used to describe media in which you do electrophoresis.
Yeah.
Gels made of agarose, gels made of acrylamide. And in that case, it's a solid material that you force molecules in by virtue of electric current, and they act as a sieve. And the bigger molecules are move slower than the smaller molecules. Gel filtration is a pretty specific term described to, I would call it, a type of chromatography where you have beads in a column. And so I guess the beads are called a gel, but it's not the same as the kind of gel you would use in electrophoresis. But they are beads in a column, and they filter because you let stuff, gravity feed or pump through this and do the filtration. I think I've done this on TWIP before, but I want to do it again because I have a wonderful analogy for how gel filtration works. It's counterintuitive. It's weird because if you have beads in a column and you run a bunch of molecules through it, some are big and some are small. And what happens is the big ones come out first and the small ones remain behind. It's a reverse molecular sieve. The reason is that the beads have pores in them. And the small molecules get hung up in the pores, and so they take a longer time to come out. The large molecules can't get in the pores, and they go through the larger spaces between the beads. And my very first mentor as an undergraduate described it as the gel matrix. The beads are like a forest, and you have a bunch of adults and a bunch of kids, and you send them running through the forest, and the adults come out first because the kids climb the trees.
Excellent.
That's very good.
Yeah.
Do you have something to say, Rich, about the origin of the word chromatography?
Actually, I hadn't thought about that, and I'll bet you got a story, Dixon.
Well, a little bit of a story, at least. It goes back to the turn of the century and the Wattman Paper Company. Mm-hmm. Wattman papers were originally used for artists to do watercolors on. And if you wet the paper first and take some of the watercolor paints that they were using, which are made from plant pigments in the original watercolors, and you spotted it on the paper, you can get the colors to start to separate. So somebody thought about just hanging the paper up and, you know, allowing it to remain moist, and you place these pigments of paint at the top, and then you can wash the whole thing down, and you can watch them actually separate based on their affinity for the cellulose on the paper.
Right, so
you got a chromatography.
Right.
The chromo part was the actual color of the plant pigment that separated from the other plant pigments, and you could watch that happen. So the word chromatography, I think, started with that idea.
And I think that here's another situation where the word is a little confusing because it can be used to describe paper chromatography, where you apply something to paper as you described, separate it by running some buffer through it. But it can also be described it can also be used to describe columns, as she rightly points out, ionic, hydrophobic, affinity columns, where you have some sort of matrix in a column and you pump a solution over it and it separates molecules based on their affinity for that particular matrix.
Right.
But these are not really different processes. They're just the format is different.
Yeah. True.
But the fundamental physics of it is
right, is
the same. What you're doing is you're taking a complex mixture and you're forcing it or allowing it to flow through some kind of force, be it gravity or electricity or hydraulic pressure, through some kind of matrix. And that matrix is one that you've chosen because it differentially affects the different molecules in the solution and allows some to move through faster and some to move through less fast, and that separates it out.
I had a secretary, by the way, who was fascinated with my column chromatography that I used to run to separate antigens from trichinella. And I used to include into the solution a large molecule that was linked to some blue color. And I used nickel chloride for the green color for the very, very small molecules. And I had two intermediate size molecules that were one was yellow and one was orange. And I mixed them all up together for her, and I said, now watch what happens next. And she thought it was just magic. Great. You know, the pump would put them into the top of the column all together, and the the blue color would come down first, and then all the others would line up behind it. And she said, how does that work? You know, and I could stand and draw little pictures for her and actually show her how it works. So it's great to see something like this happen as well as to describe it in words.
Oh, yeah. That's a great one. I'd like to reconstruct that, Dixon, and film it.
That was a lot of fun, though, actually. I had a great time doing that.
I wonder if there's a chromatography film on that website that we had as a pick last
week. I'm sure. Yeah, there are a couple of websites we picked one on procedures.
It was a bunch of techniques,
Or the Journal of Visualized Experiments. That might be another one.
I subscribe to Chemical and Engineering News of all crazy publications. And in it, there are huge ads for improved chromatography apparatus and columns, and they show you these wonderful pictures of the older versions, the competitors, and then theirs, of course, gives you a much sharper definition.
So, you know, when you drive by a refinery, they got these big towers.
That's right.
My understanding is that those are columns, basically.
It's slightly different.
Yeah, those are your distillation columns.
Yeah, those are distillation columns. Okay. What you're actually doing is you're heating a solution under reflux, if you remember all the way back to organic chemistry class.
Oh, yeah.
So you heat the crude petroleum under reflux, and it bubbles up and redistills and equilibrates at a particular level in the column. It's kind of a similar concept, but it's
so that's a pretty big reflux condenser.
It's a huge reflux condenser.
It's done at a graded temperature so that each it's called cracking with the crude oil.
You grew up near those, right, Rich?
My father worked at Chevron Research, so he was an organic chemist. His office was on the site of the Chevron Research, the refinery in Richmond.
Yeah. Cool.
I grew up with one. It's right here in Linden, New Jersey. It's a big one.
CME News publishes a breakdown also of the top paid science groups, and the top pay for any graduate is chemical engineer. Hmm. They get the most money of anybody graduating.
But I think we digress.
Oh, no.
Rich, you...
Really? It's interesting science. It's how science is practiced.
But before we move on, Rich, you had a great story about your dad and plastic. We have to tell it one day. In fact, I have a great story. Everybody has a great story. Someday we should do an episode on our stories.
Stories.
You're here.
Yes. Actually, I told a whole bunch of stories about my graduate work to a group yesterday. And, you know, the stories are part of the deal.
You'll remember them. You could do it again, right?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Let's see. Are we up to Rich?
Okay.
Before we move on, sorry, Judy says, once again, thanks so much. Can I vote for more TWIP?
Sure.
Judy's from San Diego, California. Okay, Rich.
Elio writes, and we can reveal that this is Elio Schechter, right? From
yes.
Co-host of Small Things Considered. Hi, Twivers. I like this letter. This is fun. Regarding your discussion of the term prokaryote in TWIV number 93, this is almost as hot a topic as living or dead.
That's right.
Yes.
I want to pipe in as a combatant in the P-word wars. I am firmly in the camp of the users of the term. Although the term has carried a phylogenetic burden, meaning that it originally implied a close evolutionary relationship between the bacteria and the archaea, no one I know uses it in that sense now. Among biologists, the three domains model is widely accepted, in fact, not even discussed. It's true that there are leftover people who think that the prokaryote-eukaryote divide denotes a single evolutionary cleft, but that's simply because any concept of science takes time to filter out. I maintain that the term used in a broad sense is extraordinarily useful. In a college textbook that I co-authored called Microbe, we used the P word some 300 times. How come? Had we not used it, we would have had to say bacteria and archaea that many times. And being parsimonious in verbiage, we eschewed that, as we've already heard from a previous guy who wanted to use live and dead, right? Or live and killed, because it had fewer syllables. This usage illustrates the reality that these two groups of microbes, though they very likely diverged very early on in evolution, share a large number of common properties. Their sizes tend to overlap. their overall body plan is generally very similar. They often occupy the same habitats. They share many homologous genes. Presented with an EM thin section, you could not tell a typical bacterium from a typical archaeon. So, dissimilar as they may be in some sense, they are very similar in a number of important attributes. Saying prokaryotes is much like saying animals or plants, large groups that are extremely heterogeneous and that diverged a long time ago, although certainly not as far back as prokaryotes and eukaryotes. I agree, there is a danger in the P word being misunderstood out in the big wide world, but there is none within the family of biologists. Anyhow, the battle has been met, and yeah, the victors are clearly the users of the word prokaryotes. The term is found all over the place, notwithstanding the astonishing campaign waged against it. Look just at the titles of recent articles in major journals. There is a more serious issue. Making phylogeny the overarching master of relatedness is readily justified if one thinks in these terms only. But isn't ecology just as important to understand the biological behavior and relatedness? Sure. There is a tyranny to phylogeny, which demands that you view the world of living things in terms of where they came from, not only what they are doing now.
I love that.
Yeah, this is really very good. I think he makes a wonderful point in the end there about how the genetics is taking over phylogeny, and that's not the whole story.
Right. Okay. The ecology of these organisms matters immensely in what they're doing now, and it's appropriate to stick with that.
That's right.
Great letter.
Yeah, very nice. Thank you.
I will put a link to an article where basically it calls us archaic if we still use the word prokaryote, just for the opposite view. But his argument is compelling.
Well, I'm relieved, because if Elio says that I can say prokaryote, then I do so.
Then darn it, we can say prokaryote.
That's right.
Yes.
You bet. All right. Thank you, Elio. And Elio and Mary, we had two from Small Things Considered in the same episode. That's great. Dixon, I think you are next.
Okay. Atlia writes, Dear Twivers, I have already written for the show but forgot to present myself. My name is Atlia Lamario. I'm a Brazilian graduate student working with HIV evolution at Universidade de São Paulo. After listening almost to all shows, I can say that TWIV is a great way to keep in touch with general virology instead of just reading articles in my narrow area. Also, you have made my dishwashing time much more pleasant. Okay. During the TWIV 90, Dave wrote about the difference between organisms, mutations, and computer program mutations. I would like to add another point of view. For me, the most important difference between computer programs and living organisms is redundancy.
You can say that again.
While computers have strict instructions to realize tasks, we have many metabolic pathways, and even important genes may be knocked out with virtually no effects. So we can afford changes in our code with much more flexibility than computer programs. I suggest an open access PNAS article comparing the differences between E. coli genes and Linux OS code, showing that their set of instructions, composition of regulators, middle managers, and workhorses have a very different distribution. Also, the bacteria have more autonomous modules of genes controlled by one master regulator, so that the loss of one module does not affect others. On the other side, Linux has many overlapping and interdependent modules, and if one crashes, so do all.
Not true.
Yeah, parens, it says. Not
no, true. No, that's my addition.
Okay, well, you read the not true then.
I said not true. Linux, Unix operating systems are built on a kernel architecture, so the kernel of the OS will keep running even if a sub-process crashes. Right. I think he's thinking of the way Windows is built.
Aha. Right, okay. Also, Dave ends the letter asking if there is any biological entity that self-mutates. I want to add that viruses can self-mutate, too, and not only via its nucleic acid polymerase. In the last years, it has been found an enzyme called APOBEC3G apolipoprotein B mRNA editing enzyme catalytic polypeptide-like. That's a mouthful, guys. No matter which way you read it, that's a mouthful. That is capable of attacking single-stranded RNA at a DNA at the cell cytoplasm. It eliminates cytosines, mutating them into uracils, hypermutating HIV genome into many G2A changes. HIV has an accessory protein named VIF, viral infectivity factor, that promotes the degradation of our APOBEC3G and allows the virus to replicate in human cells. Now comes the weird part, as if it wasn't weird up to there. They have found that some VIF defective viruses can replicate in APOBEC3G expressing cells.
APOBEC. You can just say APOBEC.
APOBEC. No, I can't. And what makes this possible is that their other accessory protein, VPR, viral protein R, stops bringing APOBEC to virus particles. So HIV can actively pack APOBEC within its particles, balancing VIF inactivation and VPR recruiting, and maybe using the hypermutation for its own benefit. Whew. Boy, he said a mouthful.
Yeah, it's cool.
Congratulations. He lists a reference in Current Biology, and then he says, congratulations for the great iPodcast, and sorry for my English. Your English is fine. It's your abbreviated virology that I'm having trouble with here. Thank you.
Also, your English is a whole lot better than my Portuguese.
Right.
No question about it. P.S. Is there a virus that infects mitochondria? It's an organelle that has its own genetic material and polymerase, so it could replicate a virus. Does the mitochondrial double membrane and the cell membrane impose a barrier that phages cannot transpose?
On reading this, I did a quick search. Not exhaustive at all, but I did come up immediately with a phenomenon in Arabidopsis, a little plant.
Yep.
And it looks like they have an RNA polymerase for their mitochondria and chloroplasts that looks very much like a T phage RNA polymerase.
Well,
so it could be that the mitochondria were infected with phages at some point in the distant past, and this is a remnant of it.
I really found that a fascinating question.
Me too.
I think it's an absolutely fascinating question, yes.
The genome of the chloroplast is quite much larger than that of a mitochondria, though. So it's more organism-like, I think, and therefore might be more supportive of a virus than the mitochondria, don't you think?
Yeah, and the mitochondria may have simply lost so many essential genes that it's not productive for a virus to get in there.
What I find amazing about the mitochondria, and this is an aside, but of course it does behave like an organism inside its host, is that there are a lot of proteins that it's needed for its complete function, which the host provides. Mm-hmm. And that's a symbiosis that has evolved over a long, long period of time. I'm not sure that the chloroplast acts the same way.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know enough about chloroplast to...
Quite remarkable. I've actually had conversations with Lynn Margulis on this subject, since she's such a leader in the area of symbiology. And she, you know, would throw up her hands and say, you know, it's anybody's guess as to what's going on here, because we have no intermediates to look at for either one of these organelles.
Okay. Thank you, Attila.
Yep. Very thoughtful.
Yes.
And I think Alan should read the next one.
Sure. So Chad writes, I found the podcast a few weeks ago, and I just listened to number 63, where Alan was talking about wine. That's the abbreviation WINE, not the beverage. He commented that he didn't know why they say wine is not an emulator, and I didn't know if anyone had explained this yet. Now, I think this is a pick of the week that I did. This allows you to run Windows software on a Mac. And yes, there are reasons why you might need to do that. So Chad continues, I've been into Linux for years, and the reason that the wine team call it that is because it installs the native Windows Application Program Interface, API, and uses that to trick programs into thinking they're on a Windows PC, thus making them run as native applications. And he describes some of the details about how that works, and says, I hope this clarifies things a bit. And it doesn't exactly clarify it for me. To me, emulation means that it's allowing my Mac to act like a Windows machine, but computer scientists obviously draw a distinction between a real emulator and something that sort of, Gather Wine is sort of faking an emulator by providing the Windows API and then using the rest of the kind of redirecting the rest of the native hardware. So thank you, Chad.
All right. PhD student in distress writes, "Hi, professors. I'm a PhD student in studying influenza. I'm writing to share with you an interesting paper I found in Virology Journal. The authors discuss the possibility of influenza infection in a story from the Bible. Even though I find their discussion rather interesting, I'm curious as to why something as speculative and unconfirmed as this can be published in a science journal. My guess is that something like this should be published in a science magazine or something similar. Just a thought." Anyone have a look at this?
No.
He didn't give us a reference, and I didn't find it. But, you know, every now and then, even Science Magazine will publish a speculative article. I think it's good to have a little bit of this sort of historical perspective,
right? Yeah, it's like
right?
medical journals will will publish speculative articles. Somebody writes an article on how Alexander the Great died.
And, exactly.
You know, it's not really medicine because it's all very speculative from sketchy records, but it's interesting.
Well, that that previous letter we had that said that polio went as far back as the Egyptians makes me the typical picture that's shown is a hieroglyphic carving, something like that, of a person who looks like they have a flaccid paralysis in a leg.
Right. That's very speculative.
Yeah.
Because we don't really know. And there are many people who don't believe it. They say it could be a number of other things. So, yeah, it's an example of that. But you can imagine, you know, when it was found, they wrote an article in a science journal saying, hey, this could be polio. It's not really science, right? All right. On another note, I'm writing to seek advice from you guys with regards to my current predicament. I seriously enjoy my work and the prospects it brings, but I am working under a supervisor who is very temperamental. He has violent mood swings, and this results in us working in fear in his lab. We often have to resort to hiding bad results and doing secret experiments to get the results that he wants. I'm halfway through my PhD and have often considered quitting, but the amount of data I've generated over the past 2 years is rather substantial and could lead to more interesting work. Most of the professors in my university are pals of my supervisor, so discussing this matter to them would not help. You guys seem to be rather nice guys. Please advise on this matter. PhD student in distress.
Wow. Get out.
Yes, my suggestion would be if it's really that bad, you say you've got time invested in this, but what happens if you invest more time in it and then your advisor throws a hissy fit and doesn't let you graduate? I would get out. I would say transfer to another lab. Rather than quitting, because obviously you're interested.
Yeah, don't quit.
But there are many, many other advisors out there, and I'm sure there are others at your university who are not like this at all.
This happens all the time. People change labs in the middle, and it's hard to do because you've spent time accumulating this stuff, and you kind of hate to leave that investment behind, but there are toxic environments out there, and life's just too short. You know, it's not worth it. It sounds to me like this is a situation that is actually conducive to bad science.
Yes,
if this guy wants certain types of results and is turning the pressure to get them, I don't even want somebody learning that. Okay,
no.
True. Well, get out. My pick of the week will be the patchwork mouse.
Yeah, sure.
You know,
so we encounter this all. We encounter this not infrequently. Students getting partway through their through their PhD, and for one reason or another, they found out that it's a bad match, and it just got to get out. And it's
I believe the Dan Savage's version of this advice is an abbreviation that he just uses as DTMFA.
What's that?
For those of you who read that column, just guessing that you might.
Okay.
It's
dump not a viral sequence.
It's dump the MF already.
Yes. Okay. Okay.
What do you think, Dixon? Do you agree he should move?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I was at Rockefeller when some students rebelled against a very famous lab director. I won't name names, but the way they found out that they had left the lab was they came back the next day and the lock on the door had been changed to the laboratory. And they were asked to hand in their notebooks. And they did. And they left and they went to work with other people, and they had very successful careers that followed. And the guy who asked them to do that, well, we won't go any further with it, but... Sometimes these idiots actually succeed at getting away with that behavior, but they shouldn't.
Well, and you know, to make a silk purse out of this sow's ear, the experience, the negative experience, has its own value.
That's true.
Because you've seen the dark side.
It teaches you.
And you can live through it.
That's right. That's
and, and you know how bad it can be, and you know not to do that.
And also, in the grand scheme of things, taking an additional 2 years for your PhD, 10 years from now, it's not going to matter.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, I agree. You don't want fear. You don't want bad results.
Nope.
All these things are not worth 2 years of data. Just move.
It's okay to be happy, you know?
Yeah, that's
happy
right.
is good.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, go to Rich Condit's lab.
Hey, that could work.
The weather's good. Everybody's happy. All right, let's move on to our picks of the week.
Good.
Let us start with Dixon, who's already given his away.
Yeah, no, it's I'll pick it based on that last letter, the patchwork mouse. You can see what happens when you try to please somebody to the point of faking data to make them happy. This guy, Summerlin, actually faked data so that Robert Good could go around the country and praise the kind of work coming out of that laboratory. And it ended up with both of those people taking a nosedive in terms of their careers. It's a good lesson. It's a good lesson in ethics.
Painted the color on the mouse. It's something to do with transplantation, yeah,
Claimed that he could transfer the skin of a white mouse onto the skin of a black mouse and vice versa without rejection, because he had figured out tissue rejection immunology, and in fact he had not.
Yep.
Maybe it was an accident that resulted in the first result succeeding, but after that he could never replicate it. So one day he was in his laboratory. He thought he was alone, and he was there coloring a black patch on a white mouse. So that they could have a demonstration of this the next day when his director, Robert Good, was going to bring back all these big funders to show them how this thing worked. And a technician was actually observing his actions and reported him. And the rest is history.
Wow.
Yeah, Rao was right. Robert Good was the director of Sloan Kettering Research Laboratory.
Yep, he was.
He had 2,000 publications to his name. Some of which he'd actually read.
We've said many times before that science is self-correcting. You know?
Not only that, Robert Good was a very, very wonderful immunologist. He made lots of important contributions to the literature. He just had an ego that wouldn't stop.
Hey, ego in science? Boy. All right.
Go read that book.
Thank you, Dixon.
You're welcome.
Rich.
So we mentioned this last time. It's a YouTube video that was made it wasn't a YouTube video when it was made. It was made in 1971. It's a movie that was made at Stanford that uses a bunch of students in a sort of a dance format to illustrate protein synthesis. Okay. And the comments on the video are as hilarious as anything else. The video is really great. It's introduced by Paul Berg in his nice, thin 70s tie. Looking very, well, I guess he looks kindly. He's okay.
He does.
And then they have this, he gives a nice overview of protein synthesis, and then they have a bunch of students who dance this thing out in a very hip sort of 70s format. With the narration is an adaptation of the Jabberwocky that they've spliced in a bunch of stuff to make it a narration of protein synthesis. One of the comments here is the real title should be Hippies on Exogenous Chemicals Representing Endogenous Chemicals.
Yeah.
Excellent.
That's pretty good.
Here's another comment that says proof that the 60s and 70s should never have happened.
Maybe it never did happen.
But it's really great.
That's a classic, yeah.
Yeah, it is a classic.
Very good.
And it's actually a pretty good description of protein synthesis, the fundamental.
Very good. Love it. Alan?
What I have is Bill Hammack's engineering videos. It's engineerguy.com. And this guy does a series of videos. He's been on NPR and done a bunch of other things, but he's got a really cool series of videos about how different things work. And, you know, just is taking apart interesting machines and looking at them and explaining what the inner workings are. The most recent thing that he did was on the IBM Selectric typewriter, which turns out to have this fascinating little machinery inside it that's it's a digital to analog converter, but it's all mechanical. It's really, really neat stuff and very well done.
Why Engineers Need to Grow a Long Tail, his recent book.
Right, he's got a book.
On using new media to inform the public. That's what we're doing, right?
Exactly.
Nice, cool.
Excellent, very good. I love stuff
you see
like
this guy's picture here. He looks like one of us, you know.
Right, holding a hammer.
It's a little conservative shirt and sweater. You know?
So what's his motivation? He just likes to explain stuff, I guess.
Yeah.
Kind of like us.
I gather he also makes a living at this now.
Oh, okay.
Huh. So it can be done.
It can be done.
Interesting. Mm. That's cool. I like
that. All right.
Well, my link was suggested by a listener, Svetlana, who sent it along and said, hi, in case you haven't seen it yet, she sent this and said, P.S., I love your podcast. Thank you, Svetlana. It is called Visual Science. It's a website in Russia. It's a .ru site. Visualscience.ru/en, and it is just full of beautiful illustrations. Some of them are viruses. Other things are drugs and other chemicals, but there's a HIV series of images. These are, you know, high-resolution rendered images, which are just beautiful.
Oh, they're very nice.
Actually, these are models that you can buy.
Wow.
And these are pictures of the models, and the pictures themselves are gorgeous. So the HIV one is particularly amazing. I can imagine buying this. It must be very large and expensive, I guess. But it's gorgeous. I think this.
I like the flu one too. You can tell the hemagglutinin from the neuraminidase. You know.
Yeah. Drugs for treating cancer. A lot of this is in Russian. This one I've clicked on. Drugs for treating cancer is in Russian, which I don't speak. But the picture's beautiful. Nano vaccines. Anyway, it's pretty cool. Just a little eye candy. Check it out. Thank you, Svetlana.
Neat stuff.
Yeah, a lot of stuff out there. And that'll do it for another TWIV. As you all know, you can listen to TWIV in a couple of ways. You can do it at iTunes, at the Zune Marketplace. And if you do, try subscribing and leave some comments at iTunes if you haven't done so before. It helps us stay on the front page. You can also listen to the Microbe World app for your iPhone or iPad. Check it out at microbeworld.org. And, of course, you can always go to twiv.tv. You can listen, you can download, and you can read all the show notes and letters. If you like TWIV, tell everybody about it. And, of course, we love your questions. twiv@twiv.tv. And recently I tried an experiment. I started a This Week in Virology fan page on Facebook. Nice. Facebook.com/This Week in Virology, all one word. Go ahead and like it, as they say, and anyone who wants can make comments and write things. It's kind of cool. There's some people over there making comments, so check it out. And Alan Dove is at alandove.com. Thanks again.
Always a pleasure.
Western Massachusetts. Rich Condit is down at the University of Florida, home of the Gators. Thank you.
Quite welcome. Love it every time. It's great. Where does the time go? Oh, yeah. Thank you very much.
Dixon Despommier is in Fort Lee, New Jersey. Actually, he is here at Columbia University Medical Center, and you can find him at verticalfarm.com. Thanks for joining us, Dixon.
I love it.
Always great to have you all, actually. And I am Vincent Racaniello at virology.ws. You have been listening to This Week in Virology. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week. Another TWIV is viral.